Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea in the Parsha and how it relates to Jewish history, along with all the books and articles I've read over Shabbos to learn more about it. Just a reminder to sign up for our weekly email, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com, where you can get a write-up of our weekly class, along with all of the links to the articles and books that I've discovered on my Shabbos reading journeys. Thank you so much to our sponsors and friends, Jana and Lior Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. I'm trying to remember the first couple I ever heard get divorced. It is a very jarring thing to hear, especially as a child. Wait, not all marriages are permanent? You start paying a drop closer attention to how your own parents might speak to each other, quietly gauging if your family is going to hold up. In fact, I think I've always been fascinated with divorce. My favorite tractate of the Talmud, you guessed it, Maseches Gittin, Tractate Gittin, all about divorce. It's actually my favorite. Trust me, this didn't sound any better when I told my wife any of this. Thank God we are still happily married. But to this day, when I hear a couple is getting divorced, I immediately become very curious. I wonder why. When did they know? If they worked harder, could it have lasted? I don't ask these questions out loud. I don't gossip and try to find out the answers, but I would be lying if I said I wasn't thinking about them. I think these are compelling questions because the very nature of romantic relationships and commitment is so mysterious and central to our sense of self. The mystery of divorce, in fact, begins with its very presentation in the Torah. In the beginning of the 24th chapter of Sefer Devarim, we are presented with the source for divorce in the Torah. Ki yikach ish isha uva alav v'haya im lo simsachin be'enav ki matza ba'erv az davar v'chasav la sefer krisos v'nasan b'yadav v'shilcha mi'beso v'yatza v'haysa v'halcha v'haysa l'ish acher. Basically, it's these two psukim which the entire concept of divorce arises from or is derived from in Maseches Gittin. And it basically says when ki yikach ish isha uva alav, when a man is intimate with a woman, when they get married, and then v'haya im lo simsachin be'enav, she doesn't find charm in his eyes, ki matza ba'ervas davar, he found something. This translated over here, ervas davar is probably a sexual matter. The kasav la sefer krisos, and they write a bill of divorce, gives it to her hands, v'shulcha mi'beis, and says it out of her house. Each of these words is interpreted a whole thing in Maseches Gittin. But it's very weird that the way the laws of marriage and divorce are portrayed almost seem backwards. The Torah spends a great deal of time detailing the laws of divorce, and almost doesn't say a word about the details of marriage. In fact, many laws of marriage are only learned from the laws of divorce. That seems ominous. A principle throughout the Talmud's discussion of the laws of divorce and marriage is that marriage laws are derived from divorce because of the juxtaposition of the Torah's description of the dissolution of marriage. When it says v'yatza, they'll get divorce, she'll leave, and the creation of a new marital bond that happens afterwards, v'haysel ish acher. The Talmud calls this makish havaya liyitzia, connecting the becoming of marriage to the leaving of divorce. We are learning and deriving laws of marriage from divorce. In one incident in the Talmud, in fact, Reish Lakish literally screams at the top of his lungs like a squawking bird. That's how he's described. It says, we must juxtapose the laws of divorce to the laws of marriage. We must be makish havaya liyitzia. Why is divorce presented in such a strange way in the Torah? And why do we turn to divorce to derive so many of the laws of marriage? It seems like divorce is the main event when the details of marriage are so unarticulated in the Torah and the Talmud. To understand the significance of Jewish divorce and marriage, let's explore some of the most famous divorces in Jewish history. Sadly, Jewish history is filled with many divorces. Many notable rabbis had married that did not work. I think that's important to say. We don't often talk about that or hear about that. The only rabbi I actually know who writes about his divorce in a very powerful way is Rabbi Meir Zlotowitz, the founder of Art Scroll. In his Art Scroll biography, believe it or not, which are often, you know, dismissed as being too hagiographic or whatever it is, leaving out the gory details, there's a remarkable story in there about the story of his divorce and how he went to speak to Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was busy, couldn't get through to him. So Rav Moshe, whatever, he walked away, didn't get to hear from Rav Moshe. And this is all in the book, and this isn't even in the email. I'm just speaking this out because I think this is one of the most moving stories I've ever heard. And, you know, he was like downtrodden. He's getting divorced. His marriage just fell apart. And he goes home and he's tucking in his kids. His kids were with him. All of a sudden, it's snowing outside. He hears a knock on the door. He opens the door. door, and it is Rav Moshe Feinstein, who is standing at the door there, saw that he didn't get a chance to speak to him, and I guess heard what happened, and he came to comfort his Talmud, his student, and he went and helped tuck in all of the kids. It's just a remarkable story. But there are, it's important to mention, there are many rabbis, many great people in Jewish history whose marriages did not work. There are two divorces, however, which have rightfully received an unusual amount of attention from scholars of Jewish history, and as you will see, only one of them involves a Jew. One of the most famous divorces in Jewish history was not even a Jewish divorce. This is what I was referring to. In fact, it created, as you may already have guessed, a new church. Henry VIII was married to Catherine of Aragon. Her parents, Ferdinand and Isabella, expelled the Jews of Spain in 1492. Their daughter, Catherine of Aragon, was originally married to Henry's brother. When he passed, she got married to Henry. The marriage did not produce a male heir for the throne, so Henry sought a divorce. Interestingly, Catholics are generally not permitted to divorce because the Catholic Church believes that marriage is a sacrament, a lifelong covenant that mirrors the relationship between Christ, their Christ, Jesus Christ, and the Church. According to Catholic teaching, marriage is an indissoluble once it is validly entered into. This belief is rooted in Christian scripture, especially in Jesus' words in the Gospel of Matthew. This is where it comes from. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate. They do not believe in divorce. Henry, however, had a plan. He wanted to marry a member of the queen's entourage named Anne Boleyn, a figure I first heard of, you guessed it, from the Blues Traveler song Hook. Suck it in if you're Anne Boleyn or Rin Tin Tin. I believe that is how the lyrics go. I don't know why I'm including that right now. I apologize to all of our listeners for providing you with useless non-Jewish history related tidbits. The only way he could end his marriage with Catherine was an annulment from Pope Clement VII. When Pope Clement VII refused to grant the annulment, citing that marriage was valid, Henry needed to find another way to annul his marriage to Catherine. One of Henry's advisors introduced him to the Oxford Hebraist Robert Wakefield, who had a solid command of rabbinic sources, and devised an argument based on Talmudic sources that would render his marriage to Catherine null and void. Essentially, Henry wanted to argue that his marriage to Catherine was never binding because he was previously married to his brother, to Henry's brother, which is seemingly a violation of the biblical prohibition of marrying your brother's spouse, which is in Sefer Vayikra, Perek Yudches Pasuk Tezayin. Of course, right, it's the Los Segala Erva Sachicha. Of course, the laws of Yibum, Levirate marriage, which is about specifically marrying the widow of your brother, makes this far more complicated because there are circumstances where there is an outright commandment to marry your brother's spouse, as is mentioned in the Parsha. So Henry's trying to figure out, like, how do we paskin? Is this a case of Yibum, or is maybe the entire marriage should be annulled? I never should have been able to marry her in the first place. Unfortunately, there were no Jews who Henry could really ask this Shiloh to, who could paskin for him. Why were there no Jews left in England for Henry to consult? Because all Jews were expelled in 1290. We've spoken about this before. There were some conversos who were living undercover in England, but Jews officially were not allowed to live in England at the time. So his advisors traveled to Venice in order to figure out if, in fact, the laws of Yibum were still binding. He didn't love the response that he got from Jacob Rafael of Modena, who sided with the church's original opinion that the marriage could not be annulled. That response that actually came up, it's owned by the British Library Board, and came up in an exhibit recently. Some really cool articles about that, the original response that he wrote. It was during this time that Henry VIII purchased the 9-volume set of Talmud published by Daniel Bomber, which had been completed just a few years prior in 1523. This is happening, that's when he finished the first printing of the Bomberg Talmud, and this is happening around like 10 years later. Without a clear path to annulment from the church, the Italian rabbinate, or from the Talmud, Henry VIII did the next best thing. He started his own church. Henry broke from the Catholic Church, declaring himself the head of the Church of England through the Act of Supremacy in 1534. This allowed him to annul his own marriage and led to the English Reformation separating England from the authority of the Pope. An interesting postscript to the story is how the Bomberg Talmud that was purchased on behalf of Henry VIII wound up in the hands of the famed Jewish bibliophile Jack Lunzer. He had spent his entire career as a book collector in search of a complete set of the original Bomberg Talmud. Eventually, he bought the Talmud that was purchased on behalf of Henry VIII, which had become the crown jewel of his his collection known as the Val Madonna Trust. It is one of the most remarkable stories in the history of book collecting. And as my friend, the incredible Talmud Chacham doctor, all-around Renaissance man, Dr. Jeremy Brown, retells, he writes on his Talmud blog, in the 1950s, there was an exhibition in London to commemorate, this is the story of how he got it, the readmission of the Jews to England under Cromwell. We've spoken about this in the past, and the whole story with Menashe ben Yisroel. Lunzer noted that one of the books on display from the collection of the Westminster Abbey was improperly labeled and was in fact a volume of a Bamberg Talmud. Lunzer called the Abbey the next day, told them of his discovery, and suggested that he send some workers to clean the rest of the undisturbed volumes. They discovered a complete Bamberg Talmud in pristine condition, and Lunzer obviously wanted it. But despite years of negotiations with the Abbey, Lunzer's attempt to buy the Talmud were rebuffed. Then, in April 1980, Lunzer's luck changed. He read in a brief newspaper article that an original 1065 charter of Westminster Abbey had been purchased by an American at auction, but because of its cultural significance, the British government were refusing to grant an export license. Lunzer called the Abbey, was invited for tea, and a gentleman's agreement was struck. He purchased the charter from the American, presented it to the Abbey at a ceremony in the Jerusalem Chamber of Westminster Abbey. The 9 volumes of Bamberg's Babylonian Talmud were presented to the Val Madonna Trust. You can hear Jack Lunzer tell the entire story here. I have the video in our weekly Substack. You guessed it, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. And you can hear him tell the entire story. And it eventually sold for many, many millions of dollars very recently when the Val Madonna Trust was sold by Sotheby's. A second story about divorce. Let's get into it. It is the famous story of, you probably already guessed it, the Cleves Get. Like many, I heard about the story of the Cleves Get from my friend and teacher, Rabbi Dr. Aaron Rakefet Rothkopf. Aside from being one of the great scholars and raconteurs of Jewish history, Rabbi Rakefet's master's thesis was about the divorce in Cleves. As he recounts, he got the idea for studying this chapter of Jewish history from his Rebbe, Rabbi Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, who mentioned to him that would make a superb thesis. He eventually did his thesis under the guidance of Professor Agus. This is the basic story. On a Tuesday in 1766, the 8th of Elul, Isaac, the son of Lazar Neuberg from Mannheim, Prussia, got married to Leah, the daughter of Jacob Gunzheim of Bonn, Prussia. Again, this is a Tuesday, 1766. That's 100 years, exactly 100 years after the famous summer of Shabtai Tzvi, and it's the 8th of Elul. This conspicuous event, as Rabbi Aaron Rakefet Rothkopf explains, later developed into the cause celeb of responsa literature of this period. Nearly every major rabbi alive weighed in on the controversy that soon unfolded. On the Shabbos before the wedding, Isaac was already began exhibiting some strange behavior. He looked depressed and would manically pace back and forth. Despite inquiries from Leah's parents, Isaac insisted, "I'm fine," and the wedding went off without a hitch. Things began to really spiral the Shabbos after the wedding. The Shabbos Shavu Brachos. It's always a 10 Shabbos anyways. Isaac took dowry money and without informing anyone, including his new wife Leah, fled on Shabbos. He was later found living on a farm run by a non-Jew, claiming he had run to escape government persecution. There were a few other flare-ups early on in the marriage. Waitress intimated to Isaac because she had heard the story. She's like, "Are you the famous Isaac who ran away?" And he got hysterical all over again. Isaac kept on insisting he was persecuted, but did not really provide any concrete details. Eventually, Isaac decided that the only way forward was to divorce. He planned on fleeing to England afterwards, and he chose the rabbinical court in the town of Cleves, which was on his supposed escape route to administer his divorce. He wanted to flee to England. Isaac appeared before the Beis Din to execute the divorce, and he was able to answer all their questions satisfactorily. He seemed perfectly fine. Their marriage ended, but the controversy had just begun. Isaac's parents had not been present for the entire divorce. In fact, Isaac did not even inform them that he got divorced. He didn't even tell his parents. When they found out, they were outraged, immediately assuming it was Leah's parents who orchestrated the entire divorce in order to walk away with half of the marriage assets. So Isaac's father approached the head of the rabbinical court in Mannheim in order to annul the Cleves Get. The Mannheim Besden formally asked the more prestigious Frankfurt Besden to annul the previous divorce between Isaac and Leah that was executed in Cleves. The question at hand was whether or not Isaac was mentally competent enough at the time of the divorce for the proceedings to have halachic validity. On the one side was the rabbi in Cleves, that was Rabbi Yisrael Lifshitz, who felt Isaac was of sound mind at the time of the divorce. The Frankfurt Besden, however, annulled the divorce on the basis that Isaac's earlier erratic behavior was a clear indication that he was not completely of sound enough mind to execute a divorce. They annulled it. They're still married. Soon enough, more and more rabbis began to weigh in. Rav Yaakov Emden, who just achieved renown for his battles against Sabbateans, so he became kind of famous in that time, he weighed in and ruled that the divorce was completely valid. At the time, he was fine, so okay, he was a little crazy beforehand, but that does not make the get not halachic, not kosher. It doesn't possible to get. Other rabbinic luminaries weighed in as well. Most assumed that the divorce was valid. Rav Arye Lobov of Metz, known as the Shagas Arye, the title of his response also declared the divorce is valid. Rav Yecheskel Landau, of course, the Noda B'Yehuda, penned a lengthy response, accusing the Frankfurt Besden of being unnecessarily stubborn by their refusal to reconsider their annulment of the divorce. The involvement of the Noda B'Yehuda incensed the Frankfurt Besden, which was led by Rav Avraham Abush. They declared a cherem of sorts that anyone who opposed their ruling and annulled their divorce would never be appointed to any position in the community, and they wrote these really harsh things specifically directed about the Noda B'Yehuda, who's the chief rabbi of Prague. And you could see, I put it in the Substack, because way back when Rabbi Rakefet wrote his masters, it was not easy to type in Hebrew. He wrote the whole thing on typewriter, and it's very sweet because when you read it, you see his handwriting. He writes in the Hebrew of all of these responsa. We had to do it, you know, literally by hand back then. I mean, he got this. This is in 1960. That's when Rabbi Rakefet did his master's thesis on this. A divorce between two relative unknowns ended up embroiling the entire rabbinate. Rabbi Rakefet adds an interesting postscript to the entire incident. This is what he writes. As a final tribute of respect and love for their departed rabbi, the Frankfurt Jewish community resolved to engage no successor to Rabbi Avraham Abush, who validated the divorce issued in Cleves. Finally, in 1772, Rav Pinchas Halevi Ish Horowitz, that's the Hafla, wrote the Sefer HaMakne, was chosen as the successor to Rabbi Avraham Abush. Because, why? He's one of the few rabbis who never issued any responsa validating the divorce. In a postscript to the postscript, a lot of postscripts here, Rabbi Rakefet notes that Rabbi Horowitz actually did, in fact, pen an entire responsa on the topic that did argue on Rabbi Abush and validated the divorce. But what happened? Ink spilled all over the finished responsa. He was convinced by another rabbi present not to even bother rewriting it. Perhaps the most fascinating part of the tale is what happened to Isaac and Leah. According to one account, as cited by my friend, the incredible author, rabbi, rav, speaker, educator, Rabbi Pinny Dunner, in his marvelous account of the Get of Cleves. I mean, he gets into all the nitty-gritty, and that's in his fascinating, utterly fascinating book, Mavericks, Mystics, and False Messiahs, Episodes from the Margins of History. I can't recommend that book enough. It's so much fun. They eventually reconciled. They abided by the Frankfurt decision that the divorce was annulled. So neither dated anybody else because they really felt that we're still married. But still, when they eventually remarried, just to be sure, so they had a remarriage, Isaac said to Leah, "At od mikudeshes li b'tabat zu kedash Moshe v'Yisrael. You remain my betrothed. You remain betrothed to me." And this brings us back to our parsha and the unique approach of the Torah to marriage and divorce. My dear friend and colleague, the ever brilliant Rabbi Itamar Rosenzweig, has a powerful article on the Torah's conception of divorce. Divorce, argues Itamar in a deeply sourced Hebrew article that, of course, I link to in our weekly Substack. You guessed it, reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. Divorce, argues Rav Itamar, is what allows us to preserve an idealized form of marriage. A marriage should be a spiritual, loving union, and a marriage that is filled with fighting, jealousy, and negativity undermines the very point and purpose of Jewish marriage. Divorce preserves the sanctity and purity of marriage. As opposed to Christianity, Judaism not only recognizes divorce, but sanctifies it. This gets gets to the very heart of the differing notions of Christianity and Jewish perspectives on exile itself. The destruction of the temple and our current exile is compared to a divorce. As Rav Tzadok notes, all of the stories about the destruction of the temple appear in Maseches Gittin, which discusses divorce, because the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash was, so to speak, a divorce between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and Amcha Yisrael, the Jewish people. When the temple was destroyed, Christianity looked at this as a definitive sign that God had proverbially severed his marriage with the Jewish people, an act that cannot be reversed. It's done. It's finished. The Jewish people, however, sanctify the absence and exile as well, understanding that even within the distance created, divinity can still reside. Divorce is actually what preserves the sanctity of the idealized relationship, one we still pray will be returned. We talk about HaKadosh Baruch Hu being machzir grushaso. Divorce then is not just another commandment, but a central part of the Jewish conception of relationships themselves. In order to preserve the sanctity of our relationships, we must also have a sanctified process to dissolve them. When absence serves a holy purpose, it is sanctified as well. When Rabbeinu Tam, one of the most prolific Bali Tosos, was asked about writing a name of an idol in a get, like somebody named Chris or something like that, a Jewish divorce document that's called a get, he cried out, Chalila lahazkir shem avodas kochavim b'toras Moshe v'Yisrael. God forbid to mention the name of God in the Torah of Moshe and Yisrael. A divorce is more than a contractual agreement, just as a marriage is more than an acquisition. It gets to the very heart of the Jewish notion of intimacy. Perhaps that is why divorces elicit the controversy and response they do, as evidenced in Cleves. Whatever the case, we continue to pray that God reunites with the Jewish people and reminds us with the much needed comfort, At od kudeshesli b'tabazu kadash Moshe v'Yisrael. You, the Jewish people, remain my betrothed. So thank you again for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. To get the links to all of the articles and books mentioned, be sure to subscribe to our weekly email, Reading Jewish History in the Parsha.substack.com. Thank you again to our dearest friends and sponsors, Janet Lior Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. Thank you so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.